Okay.
All right. Good morning. Good afternoon, folks out there. Gene Panasanka here with Straight and Unfiltered, coming right back to you. Thanks for tuning in. If you're new to the channel, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, and hopefully you're gonna like the interview. I have a great treat for you. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Mr. Thomas Kayser, who is a founder and CEO of CNXmas, a deal-driven enterprise focused on international trade services and technology. Thomas Kayser had previously published his book, actually just came out recently, a couple of months back, Memoirs of a Trade Facilitator. The world was my oyster. A fascinating read, truly so much fun and wealth of information. It details his extensive experience of working in South Eastern Asia and Pacific Rim countries. So Thomas, again, I know we've been trying to line up this video for quite some time, so glad to see you here. Welcome to the channel.
Thank you, Gene, for the introduction. Sincerely appreciate it. I should have brought my own book.
Well, I got it here with your wonderful autograph. So again, I truly appreciate, lots of fun, absolutely incredible experiences, described here. So please take it away. Originally, you're from Long Island, just for the audience, Long Island, New York, and now residing happily in a wonderful state of Kentucky.
that is that?
Wonderful state of Kentucky.
Oh, thank you. Even though I have my hearing aids in, Gene, it's difficult for me. But Kentucky,
Take it away, Thomas. Yeah, take it away. Yeah.
very much. My
Go ahead.
son's here, as you well know. He's retired from the U.S. Navy. Purchases a farm from his in-laws,
And
and.
thank you for your service for that. Yeah, Thomas, you and the
Yeah.
family, Alex, I mean, you served, years, decades in the US Navy, and right now going through the, holiday weekend, the Memorial Day weekend, we salute all those fallen, who fought, for our freedoms here in the United States. So we salute you all, and thank you so much for your service and your family. Yeah.
And a salute to you too.
God bless. A amen.
Where would you like to start?
Well, anywhere you want to start. I mean, it's just so much stuff. I mean, we could probably do a 10-hour long interview, but I know you're pressed for time on this holiday weekend, so let's just dive right into it.
Okay. Basically, I'll start with the reason for writing the book. Was that I think I had mentioned to several people that to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. What is meant by that is that my experience going overseas for 26 years trying to facilitate trade between China and the US or the US and China. The situation was that the US companies would hire me, I would bring the products over, so forth and so on. Wasn't as successful as I thought that it would be, even though I had lots of support there. So I thought that by writing this book, I would be able to, let's say, subsidize
Right.
myself in my retirement years.
Yeah.
How this whole thing got started actually by accident. I met a, actually, what happened here? The cleaners, the dry cleaners down the road from where we live, they
Right.
sold, the Italian family sold to a Chinese family. And I became friendly there with the people, the owner and her partner. Her partner, Sai Pei Sao, was a kung fu martial artist.
Right.
Very powerful guy. Two handstands with two fingers. I met prior to all of this, I had met an individual and we had served together, and he had opened up a Taekwondo studio. From there, he attracted some of his other friends, so forth and so on. So I was reliving my youth. He happened to, Sai Pei Sao happened to see me in the at the dojo, and when I came in one time, he it became a competition between he and myself. To shorten up the story a little bit, Hui Hsien Wong's nephew came to visit. In the introduced him as a doctor.
Right.
As time went on, she said to ask me if I could help him. Now, how would I be able to help this individual get a position here in the United States, even though I worked at that time for Health and Hospital Corporation? I had lots of connections, but
who would be
a foreigner from China coming here? Okay, so I asked for a CV. I gave the CV to my wife.
That's a resume for the American audience, yeah.
Yeah, to check for the medical criteria. Now, I was amazed by the number of topics that he had written about in his CV. And I turned it over to Vivian, my wife, to review. She says, you know, the fellow's only, 24, 25 years of age.
And Vivian, just for the audience, Thomas, Vivian is in the healthcare industry, correct?
Vivian's in malpractice insurance.
But he has medical background.
Yeah, her medical background is par excellence.
Yeah.
So she reviewed it and she said to him, geez, he's only 25 years of age. And he says that he's participated in 750, cranial operations, you know,
right.
Something to do with the brain. She says, that, you know, it's hard to believe. So I invited him over to the house, Hui Xian and Wen Chong Huang, and we had a conversation. I said, you know, Wen Chong, I said, look, I said, I can introduce you, but you're 25 years of age. A brain surgeon here in the United States is maybe 35, 45 years of age,
right.
And so forth and so on. I said, you far exceed what the normal doctor does here in the U.S.
Right.
So he explained his situation. And I started to think about, you know, how am I going to introduce this person? So it just so happened I was transferred to another hospital and I had done a lot of work for this particular doctor. And he happened to be, I believe he was Japanese. So I gave him the Wen Chong's CV, and he introduced my Japanese doctor friend introduced Wen Chong to I forgot the guy's name. He you don't remember?
Wise.
Who?
Dr. Wise.
Oh, Wise Young. Ah.
Not Wise.
I have my partner here. My extended memory.
Yeah.
He introduced, my doctor friend introduced Wen Chong's CV to Dr. Wai Zhong. Dr. Wai Zhong is world renowned in spinal cord surgery. And he accepted Wen Chong as his director of spinal research. And I thought, oh my God. So one thing leads to another, and everything was done through friendship. Wen Chong introduced me to someone else, which was unbeknownst to me. He knew my schedule when I was in the city. 1313 Mott Street, I would have breakfast there at times, sometimes lunch, so forth and so on. And along the way, I meet this gentleman, and there was only one seat available. Now, I don't know if it was prearranged or not. I'm not going to go into that, but... So the waiter sat me down there and I ordered my standard order, three precious ingredients.
Right.
And so my table mate, he in turn starts a conversation. And now he's well-dressed, suit, tie, so forth and so on. I'm saying, you know, this is odd. I said, ordinarily, you know, Asians are not that outgoing.
Right.
So one thing led to another. To shorten up the story, I became an advisor for his TCM company. The TCM, Traditional Chinese Medicine Company, in turn, that he established in New York City and Long Island City, was for the registration of Chinese, traditional Chinese products here. That's an entire different industry, but unique and quite an education that I received there. And at that same time, let's see, I'm progressing, I'm fast forwarded. The Dietary Supplement Act was being introduced.
1991, I guess, right? It was a bipartisan act when senators on both ends of the aisles, they made a proposal of the bill that was actually signed into law in 1991 and that pertains to dietary supplements. Am I correct, Thomas?
Thank you for the assist. Okay, it's great. Well, Harkins and, I forgot his name. I don't believe it. He introduced it. Bill Clinton signed it. And suddenly, I don't want to use the fellow's first name. Wu said to me, he said, right, do something about this. I said, maybe do something about this. He said, yeah, this is an opening. He says, we'll look for new products. Right. So I was looking for new products and I came across stevia. Stevia is like 150 to 400 times sweeter than sugar.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's
hundreds of times as sweet as sugar. That's pretty intense, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a South American product. The Japanese had it.
Right.
They were processing it, and they were using it in their products. It's small. Right. Oh, geez, this is great for us. You know? So I contacted I think it was a Peruvian product, but I may be wrong. I contacted the people. And I said, sure. And they, lo and behold, I find out that here in the U.S., it's banned. I said, oh, geez, banned. And they said, well, you can import it, but you have to import it in 5 to 10 pound boxes. And you can't pack it. Later, I found out that you can't put it in a small pack. Well, fast forwarding.
Who was regulating them, Thomas? Was it FDA who was regulating the dietary supplements?
You're going to open up a whole bandwidth here. Yeah, a whole bandwidth.
Right.
To let's say the FDA, NIH, CDC.
Okay. So it's the whole spectrum of entities and agencies that had to regulate those kind of supplements. That's what you're saying.
It was highly regulated.
Yep.
We received a letter stating, in effect, that we could not sell it. That's being gentle, so to speak.
Okay.
The FDA, in turn, let's see if I have it. No, the NIH, I believe, does the research and development. The FDA does the marketing, and the CDC does the distribution. Okay, and there's a high, there's such a connection between Big Pharma and the three organizations.
Right. We're not going to go into depth on that relationship, but I would like you to expand, Thomas, on how you have been able to successfully and so expeditiously, if you will, launch the business on this end of the spectrum. And that resulted in your multiple and extensive trips to Southeast Asia. I'm sure that the audience would love to hear about that.
Okay, just once.
He wants to know how you were able to launch and about your trips back and forth.
Oh, your trips back and forth?
Not getting into
Not into the political atmosphere. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was able to secure 60 dietary supplement products, which I took to the there was several trade shows. There was anywhere from 1996, 99, 98, so forth, and 98, 99, 2000. Well, in certain cases, the products were basically successful. But what happens is that there's only a product life is 3 to 5 years. That's
right.
All. Okay. So during the same period of time, I'll fast forward instead of in lieu of the trials and tribulations of trying to enter and get clinical trials for some of these things here. Well, during that interim period, I became an advisor, one of 12 for the Department of Commerce with the U.S.-China Housing Initiative. With that, that was a whirlwind tour that I was on. I was in China for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
And forgetting about the military parade, if you saw the background, the side streets filled with all of the, major organizations and schools and things of this nature, and all of this, I just think of New York City, you have Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And all of the side streets leading into Fifth Avenue, you have thousands of people on each side of the street.
Right.
Each one of them is carrying a small packet. And as they're progressing to Tiananmen Square, the packets are opening. And once they're in Tiananmen Square, you see this red, flower garden above the people's head with the calligraphy in yellow. It's a beautiful execution. All right, after that, we go back to the hotel, and I'm off to, Hainan, Guangzhou, Hong Kong, Yantai, Yunmingyong.
Well, Macau was one of the areas that you visited as well. Macau, obviously, the former Portuguese colony that was established all the way back in the 16th century, that actually served as a major trading center, for Europe, China, Japan, and the whole Southeast Asia, correct?
Yeah, Macau has an interesting history. It was founded, and it was the first European enclave founded by
the Portuguese.
And from there, it developed. The Portuguese, I could say, they were basically not warlike, okay? They developed the island. The Jesuits, in turn, went along with their, development of Christianity, so forth and so on. But it was well accepted. Macau is a beautiful place to visit. I mean, it's spectacular. The buildings are spectacular. The food is fantastic. In order to get to Macau, you would take a hydrofoil from Hong Kong.
Right.
It was Pier 7 or something of this nature. I'm pretty sure it was Pier 7. But in any event, that's a fascinating ride. That was after some trade shows. I'm trying to collect my thoughts, which sometimes my thoughts wander, as you know.
That's why I'm lucky that the audience should be fortunate to have your book. Everything is nicely organized chronologically, and yeah, fascinating stuff.
To return, it's about an hour trip. It's fascinating, going to hydrofoil. So I would go to this Japanese restaurant for takeout to eat on, to take on board to the hydrofoil. Now they have service on the hydrofoil, and the food is very good, but I had the partiality. So our group would go back and forth. Each time I would stay at the, the Renaissance Harbor Hotel. That's nice. And that Harbor Hotel is not far from the peninsula.
Right.
Now, the Peninsula Hotel has a lot of history. That goes back to the 1800s, I think.
That's an iconic name, definitely, out there.
Yeah, it is an iconic name. Now, what I found fascinating was the fact that Ernest Hemingway would stay Oh, I forgot. There's an island across from. I forgot the name of the island, but it's close. It's not too far from Hong Kong itself. It's a separate island, an exclusive resort area.
Right.
Eventually, during our conversation, I'll think of the name of it. Ernest would stay on the island and then eventually drift over to the peninsula. Now, I felt, very outgoing one day, and I decided, what I'll do is I'll stay at the peninsula for one night.
Right.
Well, my pocketbook couldn't afford the peninsula. So it was a walk through and conversations with a lot of the maitre d's and some of the other people that were there, the full-time attendees. And each one of them at that time was well-versed in the history. And it was really fascinating. And if anyone really wants to have some form of exploration in Hong Kong, I would go to the peninsula, provided your pocketbook can afford it, or stay at the Renaissance Hotel. And the Renaissance, you would go to Salisbury and to, I think it's Pier 7 for the hydrofoil, and then go to Macau. And it's an enjoyable ride, so forth and so on. There are a lot of other hotels in Hong Kong itself. The food is fascinating. It's basically Cantonese. There's a lot of Japanese restaurants. They have Cantonese, Taiwanese, any type of dish that you would want. Very colorful. From there, Yantai was a port city. That's very fascinating, especially when you're on the seafront and you have aisles of fish in containers. I don't know if that's the correct way of expressing it, but you can walk down the aisle and see a group of fish, whatever your desire are, octopus, clams, oysters, codfish, so forth and so on, in these containers.
Right.
They would scoop it out, prepare the meal for you, so forth and so on. And you could sit, it's on the beachfront, but they had little dining areas of 25 people. Yeah, it was about 25 people. And you have the large table with the Lazy Susan and so forth and so on. Fascinating experience. I'm trying to think. Oh, Xi'an, beautiful.
That's mainland. Isn't it what used to be an ancient capital of China? Or
right? That's correct.
Smack in the middle, yeah.
Exactly. This Wang Fei, I think, was the fellow's name. He was digging a well.
Right.
He found all these little artifacts, so forth and so on.
Terracotta, the Terracotta Warriors.
Terracotta Quartz, yes. And which they turned over these findings to the government, and the government said, this is from whatever period. They continued the excavation. Now, that excavation turned into the Xishan Terracotta Warriors. And it's a massive excavation, and all of the soldiers, in the terracotta soldiers,
right,
their facial expressions are the exact facial expressions of the individual that was in the army.
But they're all different. Yeah, it's not like
everyone
copycat replica. Yeah,
the coloring, so, and the spears and the chariots, so forth and so on. It's all on display. At the time that I got there, I left Guilin Oh, the Legion Cruz. You got to go on the Legion Cruz.
Let's hear about that.
Yeah, and that's amazing. Then work your way over to Guilin. From Guilin, you go to Xi'an. But we left the hotel, and you walk down this, let's say, wide open space with all of the kiosks on the left and the right, and some in the center islands. At that time, you had access to almost anything, from Panasonic, you know, radio, TVs, things of this nature. Then what was most impressive was you can get deer skins, bear skins, you can buy the claws, you can buy whatever you wanted. You know, the problem would be how to get it out of the country and bring it here to the United States. Carpet, silk carpeting, a lot of merchants there, and all reasonably priced.
Right.
I don't know about today, but at that time.
Well, again, yeah, we're talking about decades back where very few foreigners like Americans were visiting, not just mainland China per se, but Xi'an. It's smack in the middle of the country. So very few Americans would venture that far away from, say, Beijing and Shanghai. Yeah.
You don't think that they would?
Not in the numbers we have been seeing in the last few years. That was pre-COVID, obviously.
Pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID. Now, in my estimation, it's well worth the trip.
Right.
If you want, I would venture into Mongolia or Inner Mongolia. I was there.
Yeah, let's speak about Inner Mongolia. You had some fascinating experience in that part of the world. So you want to talk about Mongolia?
Mongolia. Inner Mongolia, Mongolia, they're almost basically the same in their attitude.
Right.
Okay. I was there for the Tono. That was for the celebration of their, let's say, freedom, or their receiving their independence. The word Tono actually means roof. So right. when you're in it. It's my sinuses, Gene, I'm sorry.
No trouble.
When you're in the Gur or the Yurt, you have this four post circular dome, and all of the I'll call them rafters coming down.
Right.
I forgot the name, but it's known as a tono, and that basically is the covering. Protection for the yurt or the gar are the same, and it's for protecting Inner Mongolia or the Mongolians. Now the other facet, the weather conditions there are almost identical to Arizona, hot and dry, and I don't know how these people put on the display that they did in their full garb. When I say full garb, they have silk robes that will go from top to the bottom, maybe 6 inches or 12 inches above their heels. And they would have leather boots that go up almost knee high. And they're riding these horses, and these horses are much smaller than the average horse that we're accustomed to. The gait is a killer.
Right.
I would bounce around like whatever. And I like horseback riding.
Right.
I did until this experience. Oh my God. So there they are in full regalia, and they have their bows and arrows, and they're going underneath the horse's neck, and they're shooting at these targets. They're turning around, and the horse is riding forward. They're facing back, and they're shooting at these targets on the either side. It's like, oh my God, what a display. But what I found, the display was exciting, but the heat, I don't know how these people stayed without getting dehydrated, so to speak.
Yeah, and when you speak about that part of the world, I mean, it's worth pointing out to the audience that the temperature swings between, you know, the summertime and the wintertime are just dramatic. And it's just fascinating, as you said, how those people living really in the middle of the nature, you know, I mean, how they can stay those kind of swings, you know, from bitter cold to, you know, pretty hot during the day. Yeah, pretty amazing.
They're a hardy breed, and they're all nomadic.
Yeah.
At one time, I was trying to bring power plants over there from a friend of mine with James Yip, who's mentioned in the book. He's a professor for the London School of Commerce or Economics.
Right.
And Peter McGee, and myself, we weren't there at the same time. But the issue was, how do you change the culture from a nomadic culture, to living in the city life?
Right.
In the city life, now they're still burning their garbage outside their gar, which is outside, let's say, Ulaanbaatar. Okay.
Ulaanbaatar, the capital, yeah.
The capital. The capital is beautiful. Okay. But the but the gars are outside. So let's say during one period of time, the gars are there, then they move off and they're bringing all of their sheep and their cattle onto another area. And at that time, I was also not only the power plants, I was also trying to promote animal husbandry.
Yeah.
Which was, how do you find an animal that is complementary to the climatic conditions, the fast change that you were just mentioning, you know, from hot to cold? Where did we end up? I think I ended up in Haiti or Jamaica with their cattle, and then some from Ireland, somewhere in there. But because they were, I forgot the name of the cattle. They were quite hairy beasts.
Yeah,
they were. But it turned out that they were looking for. I was being mined for information. And that's the part that I can't say I found upsetting, but after receiving my export trade certificate of review, which had allowed me to bring all products and services from the United States to China or reverse from China to from China to the United States, a lot of people considered me to be a spy, or an industrial spy, so to speak. So both sides used me. Now, I'll give you a perfect example. We'll move from, I just had a flash, and I'm trying to think. Have you ever been to Lake Baikal? That's in Russia, by not too far from Chita.
Oh, Baikal. Well,
Baikal,
again, as you know well, I grew up in Ukraine, and anyone who knows me longer than 30 seconds, they know that I'm Ukrainian. But yeah, my extensive traveling before I had a chance to actually move to the U.S. Yeah, I've been to Baikal a couple of times. It's a fascinating place. Yeah, very, very different ecosystem. Very unique, you know, to anything else, you know, out there. Yeah.
It's the deepest lake in the world, as far as I know. I had an opportunity to try to raise funding for an individual, a producer here in the United States. it turns out that I also had an opportunity with, I can't think of the martial artist, he's now in Russia, Steven Seagal.
Well, I mean, this is disgusting. I was absolutely outraged when I heard in the news that he actually accepted Russian citizenship. To me, it's disgusting. It is the most unpatriotic thing for any American, and especially supporting that brutal, you know, criminal regime of Putin, well, you know, and Russian terrorists. So that's disgusting. But anyway, Thomas, I mean, we can speak for, like I said, we can do like 10 hour nonstop interview. Unfortunately, we are, you know, pressed for time. So
we're over.
Well, we still have a couple of minutes. I'll give you, you know, like a couple minutes to wrap up the conversation. But the book itself, again, The Memoirs of a Trade Facilitator, The World Was My Oyster by Thomas Kaiser. That's something that's very much recommended to anyone who cares about, you know, international traveling, international trading. And I'm sure that they're going to enjoy reading it as much as I did.
the information there is well worthwhile. You can purchase the book through Barnes. I'm going into an advertising booth from Barnes and Noble on ebook for $8.99.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend it for anyone that travels there. Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Gene, this was the fastest 40 minutes of my life.
It's like 5 decades compressed into 40 minutes.
Okay.
Thomas,
it's a pleasure. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Pleasure and honor is always mine. Thank you so much. God bless you and the family. Thank you all again for your service and the contribution to the great United States of America, folks. And to our viewers and listeners, hopefully, folks, you enjoy this fascinating conversation. Again, I'm urging you to take a look at the book, and I hope you're going to enjoy it as much as I did. Folks, thank you very much. Until the next time. All right. Cheers.
Enjoy.